The Big Picture, brought to you by Bible Society Australia, shining the light of God's Word into every corner of your world. And Sydney's Hope 103.2, there's always hope. The Big Picture, a Christian insight on the world of film, television and popular culture, with magazine editor Ben McKechin and scriptwriter Mark Hadley.
I'm Ben McKechin.
And I'm Mark Hadley, his spirit guide. Welcome to episode 35 of The Big Picture for the week beginning October 26. And coming up on today's show, spine-tingling times ahead with Paranormal Activity 3D.
We've also got the Australian gothic romance comedy drama Odd Bod Kook Fest, the Dressmaker.
And Tom Hanks and Steven Spielberg take us over a bridge of spies. Well, welcome to another edition of The Big Picture, where we take the intersection between popular culture and Christian faith very seriously. Always look both ways before you cross, and beware of huge runaway public celebrations. The celebration we have in our sights this week is an American cultural import, which is developing a real foothold in Australian culture. We're really not that interested in helping it along, so we'll refrain from naming it this particular festival, but it's enough to say that if you're into pitchforks, pumpkin, and children threatening you for chocolate, you'll be well served this Saturday. And if you're like me, it's also time to get the fire hose out again. But that particular supernatural shindig got Ben and I thinking, is there something sensible?
The annual celebration that shan't be named.
Is there something sensible that we can say about the dark and the demonic, particularly since there's so many devilish releases hitting the screens about this time of the year?
It's
never going to get old.
It won't.
So this week, we proudly present you with our demonic edition, dragging Hollywood's dark side into the light so that you can be ready with a response to this unnamed American celebratory season. But before we get underway, let's check the cultural calendar. Ben, what's coming up this week?
Something not entirely related to demons, Mark. At cinemas, there's a new movie called Sleeping with Other People, which does what it says in the title.
Is it a science fiction?
Mate, you'd be surprised to learn. It's a sex comedy involving horrible bosses Jason Sudeikis and Community Mad Men star Alison Brie as these sex-mad commitment phobes who, you know, discover that it might be possible for men and women to, you know, be just friends, you know, without taking their clothes off. That's what's happening at cinemas this week.
Interesting. Mm. Anyway, last night, which is Sunday, we saw the third episode of Quantico go to air. I don't know if you're watching it. Seven Network's new American import that combines FBI trainees, terrorist attacks, New York skylines, and long-buried murder mysteries. Kind of sort of 24 meets The Blacklist. Well, look out for Quantico 8:30 on Sundays because it hasn't got off to a great start on Australian television. In fact, we're roughly around the 600,000s. But it has become so big in the United States. I mean, it's pushing 7.1 million viewers per episode, which is pretty awesome, that Seven's committed to a full season. Good on you, Channel 7, for not just giving it three episodes of something and then getting rid of it.
So hello, Channel 7. On a DVD and Blu-ray around the place this week, Terminator Genisys is around. We did a review on this earlier in the year. Go and check it out on the Big Picture website. Mark, I think you nailed it on this, although I think you might have elevated Terminator Genisys a little bit more than I did. I was more underwhelmed, but at least somewhat
right
entertained.
Right up until the bus crash.
But I thought what you said was very true, which is the best bits of this movie, Terminator Genisys, remind you of how good the first two are. And if you've never seen a Terminator movie before, and this is your your introduction, you should be sufficiently enthused about Terminator, I think, to go back and watch the first two, and then you'll realize just how dramatically better they actually are. Okay. So if you want to know how good the first two movies are, watch Terminator Genisys.
Yeah, damned with faint praise. Okay, so after a few hours, starting tomorrow, the ABC premieres Making Families Happy, which follows the lives of three Australian families in crisis.
Is that a promise?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's as part of a series. It's actually a series of programs that have been on the ABC about happiness in general and how to achieve it. This is a world first experiment, though, led by two elite psychologists. not really. Wrong context. But who seek to use scientific tools to make the families happier in only 8 weeks. Oh, just TV.
Not seven. Not nine.
No. In 8 weeks, you'll be happy or the money you have not paid back. Can it be done? Well, we'll see as the weeks go by.
Some big news this week that caught our attention. After a few hours, only a few hours, ticket pre-sales for Star Wars The Force Awakens, the new Star Wars film coming in December, have eclipsed all previous pre-sale records at event cinemas around the country. There were 1,200 tickets, Mark, that were sold in the first minute at 8:01 a.m. the other day. 1,200 tickets were sold, and that grew to 10,000 tickets in 10 minutes for Star Wars The Force Awakens.
9,000 of them were for my household because the return key is stuck
Wow, your family's massive.
I know, well, we're rich now. Anyway, so we'll be selling off our own tickets. Look, The Force Awakens is basically going to reshape probably the end of the year. Sorry, as soon as
forever.
Concerned. I know. So look, the first full-length trailer for Star Wars The Force Awakens has been released to much hype. It contains tantalizing flashes of an aging Princess Leia, suggesting more favorites than Han Solo and Chewbacca will be back to return. All the speculation, though, seems to be centering on the revelation of a Force-sensitive young woman. Does Lieutenant Ellen Ripley finally have a challenger for the top power woman in space? Well, I guess we'll find out later.
We'll find out soon enough. In December, that's what's happening this week. Mark, we're up to what your kids are watching. First segment of the show, what will they be watching this week?
Well, with this week, when people get into that American October celebration that has taken over the world, it's no surprise to find out that ghost movies are running our cinemas. Crimson Peak came out this month, and the sixth installment of the Paranormal Activity franchise has just showed up, like some sort of like semi-star late to a party, fashionably there, and here we have it. Ever since 2009, though, another dose of screen spirits and spookings has been emerging from the Paranormal Activity camp.
Every single year, Mark.
I know, it's a shocker.
Yeah.
Well, and I expect that's what they're trying to achieve. The Ghost Dimension, which is the final episode. Oh, no.
Allegedly, it's the final one in this series.
The final one, so they say, is in 3D. I'm amazed it took them this long. But anyway, and it includes kids speaking backwards, video cameras that can film the supernatural.
Spooky.
I know. You can probably get that from JB Hi-Fi, you know. Just talk to the nice fellow behind the desk. Ask it, but does this camera film the supernatural? I saw that. Anyway, Ben entered the ghost dimension and discovered that movies still use the same old tactics to fight evil.
Katie, Christy, I want you to concentrate.
I need you to concentrate.
She's like in some sort of like trance state.
Where'd you get this?
From a box of like 80 VHS tapes the old homeowners left in the basement.
This tape is like 20 years old.
Tell me what you see.
I think I see two men. What are your names?
Ryan.
Mike?
We're the Fleege brothers.
Brothers?
Daddy? I can't sleep. How many noises in my room?
Bless you.
I love how it's always older cameras.
I know. The cameras from the 80s were amazing, including that they could take footage of ghosts. Have you seen any of the other Paranormal Activity movies?
No, so far I've managed to dodge this particular franchise. And I feel if this is the last one, I've done a good job.
Yeah, well done. I saw the first one and I only remembered that when I went and saw this new one. And I think I missed all the other ones in between. In 2009, Paranormal Activity was a massive hit. It was made for very little money and it made an extraordinary amount of money at the box office. And its secret to its success was pretty simple. In that it had a great marketing campaign around this idea of people capturing via effectively CCTV, using home cameras in their house to film themselves at night, and there were spooky goings on. And then every single Paranormal Activity since then has done basically the same thing, including the Ghost Dimension that we now get in 3D. Why it's in 3D, who knows? Before the preview that I went to, one of the stars of the show did one of those bits to camera where he's talking to the audience saying, thanks for being here. And the reason that this movie's in 3D is because it explains all the other things about all the other Paranormal Activity movies, all the questions that you had answered, it's going to be answered. I still don't understand what that means.
Like, why is this franchise continuing?
But basically, what happens in the Ghost Dimension without those questions being answered, I didn't think, was that another couple moves into a house in California, living in a house in California. Their young daughter starts doing weird stuff at night, you know, like touching mirrors and talking backwards and saying, Toby's coming to take me away. Whoa. And then they just leave cameras on all night to basically film what's going on. But then they do really silly stuff like don't go back over the tapes that they've recorded over that night. Instead, they just speculate about what's happening in their house. And Paranormal,
something bad happened, but we won't check out the cameras.
No.
Ah, well, you know.
So that's if you've seen any of these movies before, you know exactly what you're in for.
Don't tell me that they separate at some point to go and search out, you know, abandoned parts of the house.
I won't tell you that is exactly what happens.
I can't believe people do. Okay, we're in that season where the horrific basically sails up to the big screen. Is Paranormal your sort of typical horror release at this point?
Yeah, I think so. We saw Crimson Peak the other week, and both of us were pretty seriously disappointed in that new film.
Oh, no, au contraire.
I'll speak for you.
I mean, no, I was disappointed in the film, but I thought there's a particular suit that he was wearing was particularly lovely. I think you can get that on eBay.
But I thought that was a grand attempt at an old kind of gothic horror film. This one is more modern, so it's all about things that rush at you out of spooky corners. It's more similar to The Visit that's on screen now. So, yes, it's very much a straight-up mainstream Hollywood ghost story.
Shock
that
fest.
Is really, you have a camera set somewhere and you're just waiting for the minute something jumps at you from a corner, and or someone starts getting increasingly possessed or stalked by a demonic presence, and when they're going to flip out and do something weird like kill someone. That's really what you're waiting for the whole way through. So there's tension in the ghost dimension, but it's very familiar tension all the way through. And it's basically the same formula these movies have been following for six times over. So if you're a fan of these, I'm a little bit unsure why you want to go back for more of this, exactly the same thing over and over.
It's in 3D.
It is in 3D.
It's nothing, though, you couldn't actually get at home. Like you said, like one of your children jumping out of a cupboard. If you just gave them $5 and said, look, you do this for 2 hours, and that's basically, I'm, you know, $18 an average ticket price, I'm $13 ahead.
Yeah.
Just by paying my 5-year-old.
And hopefully, they are not being haunted by the devil.
Well, speaking of being haunted by the devil, the basic challenge in these films is good versus evil. There's always sort of like, you know, and sometimes we're on the side of good and sometimes there's some extra good characters who come in, but there's always this struggle between nasty stuff and us. What's the basic premise? What's the basic understanding about good and evil?
It takes a long time in this Paranormal Activity to really make it clear whether whatever's going in the house is good or bad. It seems like creepy, but you don't really know. The family doesn't know what's going on. And so
I'm not trying to joke about this. So we don't really know whether it just happens to be a ghost who's passing because they've lost their keys in a previous life.
Well, they seem to treat it like that, which is weird because these people now live in the modern day. They must have seen a movie before. And even they're not even reacting like a movie, though. They do, let's split up. Let's like leave our daughter in her bedroom. She's the one being like stalked by this demon.
Darling,
we think it's a demon, but we're just going to leave her in her bed like bait.
Darling,
and just wait to see what happens.
Where do we put all these sharp knives? Does anybody know where these should go?
There's many reasons why Paranormal Activity just like makes you sink in your seat and groan a little bit about what they're doing. How they present good and evil then, yeah, towards the end it becomes a lot clearer what's going on. And I'll try not to give the game away too much, but it is heading towards a presentation of ultimate evil. But the way they go about that really is to sort of suggest, well, we're heading to this point, but it's not that big a deal. You know what I mean? Like, it's not that big a deal. And a priest comes in to try to do not an exorcism, but an extermination of a spirit. And there's even talk about we may be opening like a portal to hell. But even that doesn't seem as big a deal as I would have thought it would seem to you.
I'm just going to get over the... Yeah. Oh, but did you... Darling... Did you book the air conditioning salesman?
Because you go and get a paper
week?
Out the front.
Yeah, no. Okay, well, listen, how does Hollywood go about defeating evil? I mean, do we learn anything about our approach to dealing with evil? I mean, it's a major problem in real life. Forget ghost stories.
We do, but in terms of how Hollywood tends to go about it, we do from Paranormal Activity, what we learn is it's the same old, which is you basically invent your own rules around this. And everything from the fact that the spook or the spirit in the house conveniently haunts people and doesn't really do things that you think the spirit would do until towards the climax of the film. So why isn't the spirit killing people earlier? I don't know. And then why does this priest come into the house and start saying religious sounding stuff about Jesus and God and all sorts of things, but then that doesn't seem to have much of a bearing either until you get to the climax and then it all starts coming together. And it really feels like good and evil are effectively the same kinds of power fighting against each other, a little bit like the Force in Star Wars, where they're exactly the same power. They've got the same strength. Who knows exactly who's going to win? You pretty much know who's going to win, though, because it's a Hollywood movie. Although this one ends somewhat differently, quite darkly. But what I was really struggling with a lot, there's a reference in the film to Revelation and a particular line in Revelation. And the writers of this movie seem to be attributing something that Revelation talks about in terms of Jesus and what Jesus will do in terms of ultimate good defeating evil. They seem to be handing that over instead to the devil in this movie. And what it left me thinking is...
Whoa, wow. You mean like there's a reference to Jesus that they just go, I'll appropriate that for the devil.
It seems that way. So one of the take-home lessons for me at Paranormal Activity, the ghost dimension, is go and read your Bible and check out what it actually says about what will happen when it comes to good and evil and who will triumph ultimately over it. What you see in the ghost dimension is basically just people making up their own rules about how it's going to go down. But instead, be inspired by what is revealed about Revelation 5, 6, in case a negative way, and go off and actually see what it says. And there's great hope and comfort that's afforded by what you actually read in the pages of the Bible, as opposed to what you get in the Ghost Dimension, Mark.
Okay. Well, Paranormal Activity, the Ghost Dimension in 3D, is now showing in 3D around the place and is rated M for supernatural themes, which make their presence known in 3D, violence and coarse language, which strangely is actually just 2D. It stars Chris J. Murray, Britt Shaw, and other people you've never heard of. Coming up in the next break, basically we're going to look for more fun stuff in the supernatural. We'll actually have Greg Clark from the Bible Society is going to tell us all about what he thinks the Bible might have to say to you about demons. But before we get to that, we're going to cross a bridge of spies.
The Big Picture, a Christian insight into pop culture with Ben and Mark. We're at soundtrack choice for this week. And Mark, I was going to try to do one of those fancy spiels that we do to try to set this up, etc., etc.
No, let me.
Instead of that, I was just going to play it.
Well, it's our demonic edition, so let's resurrect something from 1983.
Now we'll play it.
Jackson Thriller. What else could we be doing on our demonic edition? You know, the 13-minute video accompanying Michael Jackson's Thriller is a cultural phenomenon. It was directed by John Landis, famous for writing and directing An American Werewolf in London from 1981, as well as The Blues Brothers, 1980, which, by the way, was not a horror film. But Landis co-wrote the screenplay for the video with Michael Jackson, and it went on to become MTV's first world premiere video. It featured the voice of Vincent Price as a veteran in the horror film genre. Never going to get over that. Amazing makeup and prosthetics used to create werewolves, zombies and ghouls, and it was influenced by B-grade horror films from the 1950s, as well as the seminal 1968, The Night of the Living Dead. Thriller has been voted the most influential pop music video of all time and was named a watershed moment in the music industry for its unprecedented merging of filmmaking and music.
Now showing this week at cinemas is Bridge of Spies. Mark, you've been to see this. It stars two-time Academy Award winner Tom Hanks. He's returned to the big screen. He's possibly got his third Oscar in sight with Bridge of Spies, directed by Steven Spielberg. It's a thriller. Those guys have been involved with plenty of projects before. Getting huge reviews around the world, this thoughtful spy flick is based on a true story about an insurance lawyer. It sounds boring from the kickoff.
True story of an insurance lawyer. Come see it.
But it's based on this true story of an insurance lawyer who gets caught up in a case of international espionage. Now I'm getting a little
there
bit more.
Go.
There you go. There it is. We go. In the process, Tom Hanks's character is likely to remind us of just how beautiful faithfulness can be.
They've got our guy, our spy pilot. They've got their spy. We want you to negotiate the swap.
I'm an insurance lawyer.
Are you good at what you do?
This will be a first for the both of us.
You should be careful.
Do you know how people will look at us? The family of a man trying to free a traitor?
Every person matters.
Why aren't we hanging him? He's a spy!
We need to know what the Russian is telling you.
We're not having this conversation.
Don't go Boy Scout on me. We don't have a rule book here.
We call it the Constitution, and that's what makes us Americans.
I guess one of the first things you want to know about this film is it is a true story. And look, I think they're even quite reserved when they say at the beginning it's based on a true story. It makes you get the sense that they might have just picked up some of the details. But this is, the more I looked into it, the more phenomenal this story becomes. Hanks plays the real-life character of James Donovan. He's an insurance lawyer. Yeah, you can mock that. He actually is.
Well, that's not really mock it. Yeah.
Something else. But he, not that terrifying, really. He is a very straightforward character, you know, nothing terribly exciting, no sort of shiny edges or anything like that. And so, yeah, he does seem to be a very, very normal guy, Joe Normal, thrown into the middle of a really tense situation. You see, in 1957, America is consumed by the whole sort of Reds under the bed scare, and the idea that Soviet spies are everywhere. And in fact, in this case, there is a Soviet spy, and this fellow is Rudolf Abel, and he's played by Mark Rylance. He gets picked up by the FBI, and really, they just want to move through the trial as quickly as possible. They need somebody for a show of justice, pretense of doing the right thing. So they pick up James Donovan. They say, look, you know, this is going to be your job. What they don't count on is that he actually believes that he should be doing the best he possibly should be doing by his client.
Egad, man.
I know. And so he does the best he can in defending Abel, even though it starts a whole public furor against him. There are these incredible scenes of him just being on the train and being stared at, his home being attacked, all sorts of things. His very company that put him up to us, his firm, turns against him. His family is looking at him askance. The government is saying, what are you doing? Don't go all Boy Scout on us. We need you to know. We need to know what he's saying. You need to play along.
He does sound a little Boy Scout. I was thinking he sounds a lot like Atticus Finch, that a classic American lawyer character from To Kill a Mockingbird. Is James Donovan a little bit Atticus Finch?
Absolutely. Look, it is very much, in a sense, like that To Kill a Mockingbird. The important thing is to get at the truth, not necessarily to get at what we want. Now, as it happens, Abel is a Soviet spy, but what he's trying to say is that the process requires us to be believing, at least if we're going to defend our system of belief, then we have to at least act on it. You know, to show people that we actually believe what we believe. It's not enough.
Even in those times when you'd rather not.
Yeah, it's
just
not
rather
just enough to say.
The rule of law, we're hearing so much about at the moment.
Yeah, and that's, there's a real tension within the film that is hard not to apply to the here and now. Particularly when you think about the laws that are being introduced in New South Wales for the attempt to get detention up to 28 days without trial or charging. It starts to make you wonder, if we suspend all of the things we believe in the hope of defending them, do we really believe them anymore?
And what do we have left? Now, yeah. As much as you're saying that this does have really strong echoes of today, there's also, strikes me as this film, from what I've read about it, what I've heard about it, this seems like very ye olde filmmaking. This throwback to spy films of an age, maybe around the 50s or 60s, as opposed to more of the action focus that we get in movies of the Bond and Bourne franchises.
I think one of the most unfortunate things about this film is the trailer. Now, look, let me just contextualize what I'm about to say by saying probably one of my top three films of the year.
Okay? Bridge of Spies is.
Bridge of Spies is fantastic. It's a brilliant film. But I went in there thinking I was going to be looking at a 1950s version of Bourne, because the trailer is basically set up for all this sort of running, jumping, scaring tension. You know, spies, run, duck, cover. When it's not really like that. This film is like 13 days. It's like Lincoln. And it is a great epic piece about the need to believe and act on your beliefs. You know, it's fantastic. It's emotional. It is engaging. And it is very much centered on a man who's determined to act as according to what he believes.
But you said that there's a big focus in the movie about the opposition that's directed towards James Donovan. How total and widespread is that? And how big a deal is it in the film?
Look, I think normally in a film you actually have a sort of a holdout, you know, crowd who are on your side, so to speak. You know, if you have these sort of characters who are fighting, you know, for what is truth and that sort of stuff, you usually have someone who's going to come in off the side and say, you keep doing well, you're doing the right thing, come on, we're with you. But no, in this case, the most disturbing thing about the film is the fact that his wife is looking at him and saying, now listen, balance this up. Our children are under threat. They're terrified. You know, our daughter is almost killed at one point. Is this really worth it?
By people who are attacking James Donovan for his choice of defending this man?
Yeah. Is this really worth it? Now, to me, I think that that's very, very parallel territory for what many Christians are going through. Because it's one thing to say, look, the world is against you. It's another thing even to say that maybe your workplace is against you, or the laws might not even permit you to worship in the way that you'd like to worship. I mean, take scripture in schools, for example. You know, we're facing that sort of situation. But Christians have the added disadvantage often of those very closest to them not understanding what is going on. Family saying, you know, that she seems to have taken her religion very seriously of late, or he seems to have gone off the deep end with this whole Jesus thing. And you start to find it well-meaning opposition sometimes to quite hostile opposition within your own family trying to believe what you believe. So James Donovan is a real sympathetic character from a Christian perspective.
Or something like a role model even. Like often we go into films and you usually come out thinking that the person you've just watched, the hero of the film, the stars of the film, those lead characters, aren't people necessarily that you want to take things from. You actually don't want to be these people usually. But it sounds to me like you think James Donovan is a role model to take away, even for Christians, to affirm them in their positions they're in.
It's not like Christians lack good role models. You look throughout the Bible, you'll see people who are standing up under pressure. But sometimes it's good to look into popular culture and see people who are motivated in the same way that we want to be motivated. And James Donovan is like that. I think one of the interesting things, the film takes a twist. Like half the film is about the defense of Abel, but the second half of the film is about Donovan being drawn in to try and negotiate for the release of a downed U-2 spy pilot who's now possessed by the Soviets. And so a whole sort of like espionage thing takes place in East Germany. And it's incredible. But I feel that what is the pressure that comes to bear now is for the greater good. Now, there's actually a pressure on Christians that happens for the greater good. And it happens to be what we're prepared to say about the gospel. You find yourself in a situation where you want somebody to know God and you start modifying how you're going to present the gospel, particularly maybe the threat of what's going to happen if we don't believe, for the greater good. You know, and Donovan, even then, even though there's lots of people against him, is not going to, for the greater good, modify his stance because, again, he'll lose what he actually believes in. And I think that that's probably the strongest stance for a Christian to look at. That we don't, in our day-to-day, we are always tempted to try and make things look better in the hope that people will come to Christ. But we've got to remind ourselves that there is a real reason for people coming to Christ, and that is actually the threat of what happens if we die without God. And so the courage of convictions has at least got to go that far. Personally, I don't want to give away the ending of The Bridge of Spies. It is emotional. Let me say this. The last 5 minutes of the film, I just cried pretty much, you know, from beginning to end. And not because I was just going, I'd run out of popcorn, but basically because there is a beauty given to faithfulness in the end that is very, very touching. It is an absolute joy to look in the cinema and see that the hero is not a guy who can hit hardest or run fastest or has a clever trick up his sleeve right at the end, but it's a guy who stays the course and is the same steady faithfulness. And one look in the eye of a woman who values him at the end just broke me up. It's well worth the watch.
Wow, highly recommended from Mark Hadley. The Bridge of Spies is screening nationally. It's rated M for mature themes, violence, and coarse language. It is directed by Steven Spielberg and stars the everyman hero Tom Hanks, Amy Ryan, Alan Alda, and Jesse Plemons, who's in pretty much everything at the moment. He's in Black Mass, he's in Fargo Season 2, and he's coming up real soon in the program. Jesse Plemons is everywhere. Also everywhere is the internet, and on the internet is Insight's website. See what I did?
Very
Insights.uca.org.au. It's jam-packed with loads of reviews, including Russ Matthews' take on Bridge of Spies. He has a very similar take to you, Mark, but slightly different, and so slightly different that you should go and check out Russ's review. Very interesting, his take on what he took away from Bridge of Spies.
Well, speaking of the internet, actually, we should point people towards our Facebook page.
Do it.
Before we do that, look, if you are wondering where to get more interesting stuff from The Big Picture.
Of course you are.
TheBigPictureWebsite.com has all our sort of previous episodes, lots of sort of resources. You check out the films that you've missed and see what we have to say about them, how we can point you towards a sort of more Christian approach. On our Facebook side of things, we get a chance to have a bit of a discussion with those, sort of those same topics. And now, in keeping with our spine-tingling episode this week, we recently asked you guys what was the scariest movie you'd ever seen, and there were some pretty interesting responses. Wendy says Amityville Horror. I cannot disagree with that. That's a terrifying film. She says, freaked me out. I tried to watch it again recently, but only got up to the part where they move in, and then I had to turn it off.
That's like the start of the movie, isn't it?
It's 5 minutes in. Anyway, but, you know, Wendy, I understood. Okay, Russell says Halloween. I love this. I foolishly watched it when I was babysitting a friend of the family's kids and the front door would not lock.
Wow. Worst babysitting movie ever.
I know. And Tanya actually said Nightmare on Elm Street. She was so terrified by this film, she can't actually remember which one. So it was the one where she has a dream and then next thing Freddy Krueger comes out of the bed. Yeah, I think that's pretty much what everybody wants to do, sleep on that after you've actually watched a horror film. Why not?
Well, but don't sleep, because coming up, there's plenty of cool stuff still to come in The Big Picture, including what it's like to be a demon, Mark, and one of the oddest and best Australian movies in yonks.
You're with Mark and Ben on The Big Picture. And we've come to our press record segment where we actually take the wisdom out of the studio, as if there was any there, and actually go look for something smarter from somebody else. During the past few weeks at the renowned Seymour Centre in Sydney, the first ever Australian production of C.S. Lewis' The Screwtape Letters have been performed. Lewis is one of the best read and most beloved Christian writers. Screwtape is his novel approach to the dark side. Lewis scripted a conversation about God, humans, and our inner workings as discussed between a senior demon and his apprentice. Well, English-born, Sydney-based actor Yannick Laurie played Screwtape on stage. For press record this week, Ben asked Yannick what it was like being a demon, how he prepared, and what he did by learned by being professionally devilish.
Playing a demon was very, very interesting from a whole range of perspectives. Obviously, The Screwtape Letters by C.S. Lewis is the story of Screwtape, who lives in hell. He is a senior tempter, one of the people that goes up to Earth to try and tempt human beings who have the choice to either do good or evil into doing evil. I think it made me sort of think about the world in a different way, my faith in a different way. But as an actor as well, I have to say that sometimes when you're kind of playing the extremes of humanity, it gives you a bit more of a chance to kind of work hard. And every actor loves doing that, showing their range.
Now, I've met you, Yannick, and I can explain to all Big Picture listeners that you're a nice bloke. And so I'm just trying to picture like how you get yourself in the mindset of a demon to play Screwtape. Did you go back and take a look at some movies and TV shows for other actors' performances as demons or devils on screen? Were any of those like stood out to you?
It's a really tough one for demons and the devil on screen, because it either goes to the ridiculous or it goes to the far too sort of fantastical, almost kind of science fiction-y or cartoony. So finding real representations of evil on stage or on screen are few and far between.
I've been watching... and by real, you mean serious, as in someone taking it seriously?
I think so, because the temptation is either that you kind of you go to the kind of place that Adam Sandler did in like Little Nicky in 2000.
Thanks for bringing that up.
Yeah, I know. Classic quality film there.
What about Al Pacino and The Devil's Advocate?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and as Kevin Spacey says in The Usual Suspects, you know, the greatest trick that the devil ever pulled was by convincing the world that he doesn't exist. So there you are. Like from the start, it's difficult. I have been watching on TV Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, which is about a couple of magicians that are trying to kind of restore the respectability of magic to the UK. All fictional, obviously set in the 1800s. But there's a character in that just known as the Gentleman. gentleman who is quite sinister, and he has been my inspiration.
Your muse, if you will.
Yes.
Yeah, you mentioned earlier that you're a man of Christian faith, so I'm very interested in knowing, what did you take away from being a demon?
Sometimes we forget that the Christian walk is it's a race, and we're told that our enemy, the devil, is not to be feared but not to be ignored either. You know, Christ has won the battle,
but the battle still goes on.
Keeping sort of fighting, keeping our eye on the goal. And a lot of what Screwtape talks about is these subtle little manipulations of the truth. You know, just working away at people's perspectives, working away at, say, innocent pleasures, just to twist them into things that become ends within themselves, where God is left out of the picture. And there'll be moments where I go, oh yeah, actually that's a really, really good point about, certainly there was a scene that we were rehearsing even today about, you know, that God has given us lots of pleasures to enjoy in his world, and yet, you know, the devil, demons sort of pop in and sort of just really try to twist those into making us more focus on those than focusing on the person that has made us and wants to enjoy them in his kingdom. So yeah, it gives me a lot to think about, but hopefully sort of when I'm on stage, I can concentrate on the performance rather than its significance specifically towards me, because that might be a little self-indulgent.
Never thought I'd get to speak to a demon, Mark.
There you go.
Never actually thought it would happen, despite what movies would suggest that can happen in real life, like Paranormal Activity would suggest you might actually run into a demon one day in the flesh. Never actually thought it would happen to me, but speaking to Yannick Larry, it was actually a treat.
And you didn't have your 1980s VHS video camera.
I did not. But I really liked the last couple of points that Yannick was making of his involvement with the Screwtape letters. Sounds amazing for him personally as a Christian to think more deeply about, actually, this is serious. There is a serious spiritual battle going on. Demons and the devil are real. That's true. But thankfully, you can place more focus and more hope in Jesus and God and not get too bummed out and do too freaked out by what's going on around us. I was really, all jokes aside, I was really quite struck by his reflections on being a devil.
Well, we're punching our way through our demonic edition. And so far, we've had lots of sort of crazy things for you to go back on and dwell over. But now we're going on to a new form of sort of like terror, if you like. Titanic actress Kate Winslet, and that's no reference to her size, with an Australian accent. Not the horrifying part, but Oath, mate.
Oath.
The Dressmaker.
Struth, mate.
The Dressmaker is a film that Ben had a look at this week, and it boasts Winslet and a swag of homegrown talent in an Australian revenge comedy drama based on the gothic novel by Rosalie Ham. Now, if you think there are far too many descriptors in there, yes, this is a film with an identity crisis, but I'll let Ben get to it. All of those things are found in this strange fairy tale about the impact of a woman's homecoming upon a remote 1950s community in country Australia. Ben was quite taken by The Dressmaker, as it memorably airs out the sorts of damaging stuff that can lurk under the surface.
I need to remember the truth.
They say that she killed a boy.
So where did you go from here?
I worked in London.
Milan and Paris.
I reckon you came home for one of two things, revenge or me.
Gertrude Pratt. The dance is Saturday night.
The dress can't change anything.
Watch and learn, Gertrude. Watch and learn. I can make you the most striking girl in the room. Take your clothes off.
A murderer and a lesbian.
I know. Okay, so there seems to be a lot going on in that film. Just to begin with, what is the feel of it? I mean, did it remind you of your days growing up in country South Australia? I know you grew up in Adelaide, but let's face it, most of the South Australia is country. Anyway, we'll move on. Look, it's part Western, part Gothic, part kitsch comedy. How do you get hold of a film like The Dressmaker?
I think director Jocelyn Moorhouse has done a really good job with it. You're right, this film has got loads of things going on all at once. There's such a diversity of filmmaking tones and genres and styles all crammed into the one movie. I think a lot of viewers, though, are going to react badly to this film. I don't know if they're going to gather it all up like I did, but I felt Jocelyn Moorhouse really kept a strong handle on this. And everything from very kitsch Australian comedy, that kind of really broad Australiana, g'day mate kind of stuff was in there, as well as some very dark moments, particularly towards the end of the film. It does get quite violent in some very brief but intense scenes. In the sort of with the backdrop of what looks like to be a revenge romantic drama, of a woman who has been so affected by something that happened in her early life that she returns home, this character of Tilly that Kate Winslet plays, in the 1950s, back to this small town, so small it's like a one-street town. It's this amazing set in they've used country Victoria beautifully in this, and it's got this Western feel as Tilly returns to this town. And as you have all of this going on with this backdrop of what really looks like a more gothic drama to unfold, it has all this other stuff that comes in as well. But for me, it was very well harnessed to be something of like a surreal fairy tale, almost like a Western meets Amelie, that French film. I got a French film reference in, Mark.
There you go, finally. It's been a couple of programs since we actually talked about French films. But speaking of like Australian films, is there a sense of other Australian comedies sort of reaching over the shoulder of this one? Did it remind you of things like, you know, Muriel's Wedding or anything like that?
Mainly because it does. Mainly because Hugo Weaving's in this film as well. Great cast. Judy Davis in this, Liam Hemsworth. Both Judy Davis and Liam Hemsworth I thought were fantastic. Particularly Judy Davis. Like, I haven't seen her sort of explode on screen as well. She was the actress from My Brilliant Career, and she's done a number of Woody Allen movies, but she's been a bit quiet the last couple of years. Great to see her on screen as this crazed mother of Tilly, but you get a better sense of her the longer she goes along of why she's in the position she's in. But the sense of Australian comedies, yeah, you get it because Hugo Weaving's in the film and he's effectively doing a one-man tribute show to his character in Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. I found that a little bit strange of like why this needed to be in this film.
I understand he plays a policeman, but
he's like
he's
a cross-dressing
also...
policeman. Oh, okay. And it's like it's played for laughs and some of it's quite funny, but I didn't think it was that necessary to the telling of the whole story. That's one of the characters you could have cut loose and it would have been still the same film. But it's an amazing film that builds to points about not just how the past can affect you and how you go about dealing with that, but the community in this tiny town of Dungatar is a place where under the surface there's been terrible abuse that's been afflicted upon this community for years and years and years. And not just the fact that the abuse has happened, it's mainly from men against women. And in an age of domestic violence, the dressmaker is quite an interesting challenge to that, quite an interesting like go at domestic violence. Even though it's about abuse, it's amazing how it's been accepted in the town as well. And I think the dressmaker does a pretty compelling job of presenting how really terrible stuff can be accepted in a community. And the longer that goes, the longer it just becomes a way of life. And until someone comes and tries to break that, you're stuck in it.
So you've got abusive men and you've got like claws out women and a culture itself that's really quite destructive. And Tilly comes back into that. I understand there's a pretty violent conclusion to the film.
Yeah, there is.
Without giving anything away, do all the bad guys get what they really deserve?
Yeah, to some degree, I think you can feel some catharsis as an audience member for what actually Tilly goes on to. It's interesting. I found the film, for the most part, to be unclear about whether it's a revenge film or whether Tilly's coming back looking for healing, and I think it's a bit of both. But where you get to towards the end is basically because people are so unrepentant in this film, the people in this town just won't change their ways. What happens to them at the end? I think a lot of viewers, whether you like this about yourself or not, myself included, you will sort of do that high-fiving, fist-pumping at the end for what happens to these people because, in short, you do feel they get what they deserve.
Okay, so they're hypocrites. Is that basically the great Australian sin? Hypocrisy?
I think you might be onto something. Yeah, the film is largely about hypocrisy and how much we don't like two-faced people, people that say one thing, do another. And you get many different varieties of this in The Dressmaker, from a very zealous pharmacist to the kind of women of society in the town that will just backstab you. Even the wallflower who's wearing the glasses, and as soon as she gets an elegant dress made by the dressmaker, which is Kate Winslet's character, as soon as she frocks up and turns into a beautiful swan, she too becomes a really vicious person towards Tilly. I think hypocrisy is to the fore in The Dressmaker. I think what it really strongly reveals on all fronts, The Dressmaker, everything that it gathers up towards the end for me, particularly as it cuts a knife through hypocrisy, points to identity and where we find identity. And as much as we've been talking about The Dressmaker and it could sound like it's got an identity crisis going on, the film, I didn't think so. I thought it put all those pieces together nicely. Tilly has an identity crisis going on and she doesn't know where she's really going to find who she is. And that's what she's desperate to find. All these hypocritical people are presenting in this film that their identity, who knows who they are? Because they present one way and they don't do another. Christians can find their identity in Christ, and that just sounds like a glib statement to make. But when you dwell on what that actually means and how you can find your identity in someone else, in the traits and the behaviors and the way of life of that person, and you can actually admit that you don't come up to Jesus' standards, but he can help you drag you up to that by trying to emulate and live like he did. When you realize that your identity is found there, you don't need to place it in other people, in how they think about you, in whether you treat people well or not, in terms of what sort of frock you're wearing. That's right, in terms of anchoring your identity there, because as the dressmaker shows, all of that is like a house of cards that falls away. So Mark, you might be able to tell, I was very struck by Dressmaker, and my word of caution is I know a lot of people won't get into this movie as much as I did, but I really quite loved it, was struck by this powerful, surreal fairy tale about revenge and drama, identity and hypocrisy in the Australian outback.
Well, it sounds like a lot of Australian comedy in that it's a real like or a real love-hate affair. You know, audiences will be divided. That doesn't mean it's not worth watching.
No, I loved it.
Look, The Dressmaker stars Kate Winslet, Judy Davis, Liam Hemsworth, and pretty much any Australian actor or actress that you'd like to poke stick at. It's showing at cinemas all over the place and is rated M for mature themes, violence, coarse language, and sexual references. I'm not sure if there's anything they've left out. Not sure that does much justice, though, to just to how unsettling some of the violence and sex references can be.
Particularly towards the end of the film.
So just be a little careful. This is not one for, I think, teens. I think you'd be a little cautious there. And in fact, if you actually want a bit more of a think into the film, coming up in the next edition of Eternity newspaper, which is coming out in the pews, I think this Sunday, actually, The Dressmaker is being reviewed by our very own Ben McKechnie. So Ben will give you all sorts of insights into that comedy or thriller or gothic romance, whatever it actually is, he'll tell you. So check out Ben's review in the November edition of Eternity.
Still to come on the show, the top five devilish performances of Satan on screen. You're right to be afraid.
Christian writer C.S. Lewis, who wrote the Screwtape Letters that Yannick Lowry starred in, said there were two ways people tended to think about demons, either far, far too much or far, far too little. The Good Book takes a more balanced approach. Bible Society Australia's CEO and social commentator Greg Clark is back to help us think through what the Bible has to say about which way to jump when you hear the bump in the night.
For I am convinced that neither death nor life, neither angels nor demons, neither the present nor the future, nor any powers, neither height nor depth, nor anything else in all creation will be able to separate us from the love of God that is in Jesus Christ our Lord. That's from Romans chapter 10. What a comfort this verse is to any Christian who has watched too many horror movies. Chatter about demons and devils and evil spiritual beings has been pretty constant in human history. But in the West today, it usually ends up on the big cinema screen, and it's usually in a horror film. But how much of what we see in these films bears any relation to what we know about the demonic from the Bible? The answer is not much. In the Old Testament, Satan only turns up in three passages. But the reality of Satan is treated extremely seriously in the Bible. Satan is the opponent of God and God's people. We just don't have that much detail on him. In the New Testament, we do hear a good deal more about Satan and demons, and Jesus described his own ministry as driving out demons and healing the sick, and these two things often went together. He famously cast demons out of a man into a herd of pigs, an event that's recorded in three Gospels. And Satan is the ever-threatening opponent of Jesus' ministry, from the time of his temptation in the wilderness and onwards. Clearly, this is a significant part of Jesus' story. But the most important part of it comes when Jesus dies on the cross and wins victory over every force of evil, in heaven and on earth, now or in the future, as our Bible verse reminds us. The most important Bible teaching about Satan and demons is that their power is defeated by the death of Jesus on the cross. Well, how do you react to this sort of information? People tend to react in three ways. Some don't give demons or devils a moment's thought. That person needs to pause and remember, you can only be so relaxed about demons because of the Lord of Light, the Prince of Peace, who has already won the battle over evil, and we are the grateful beneficiaries of his sacrifice. But some people are fascinated by this stuff and spend way too many hours reading books on the topic and watching YouTube documentaries of dubious value. If that's you, perhaps you're overdoing it. You should keep demons in the place that the Bible puts them, on the edge, nearly out of view, already defeated. The other type of person is filled with fear at demons. This one needs to take heed of the verse from Romans that Jesus has already won the war and the battle is heading towards its end. And those who love Jesus are eternally safe and sound.
You're with Mark and Ben on The Big Picture, having a look at a Christian, sorry, having a look at popular culture from a Christian perspective. At least I know what I'm doing.
that is what we do, Mark. And we've gone from what the good book has got to say about demons and the devil to what cinema, what Hollywood, what the screen has got to tell us about Satan, the devil on screen.
I'm particularly interested in the top
Mark,
five this
you
week.
You do have a particularly gleeful
I do.
Slash somewhat, malicious
I
look
say,
in your eyes.
Yeah, I was not going to go demonic, but
no,
still, yeah.
I wasn't. So let's get into top five, devil on screen.
Five.
I was going to go with Rosalinda Celentano from The Passion of the Christ. Remember that lady who played the devil? Creepy as.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I decided not to. Instead, at number five, I've gone with Elizabeth Hurley in Bedazzled from 2000, year 2000. She played the devil herself. You could call her Lucifer, I guess, if you wish. Lucifer. Bedazzled is a remake of a Dudley Moore original film from the 60s.
I can't believe you swung so completely from The Passion of the Christ over to Bedazzled.
From the super serious to the not so super serious. What I discovered as I was looking through Satan's on screen is a majority of the presentations of the devil, Satan on screen, if someone turns up as saying, I'm the devil, they tend to be for jokey effect. That's usually, and most of the list, as you're about to see, has those people on it. So I thought I'd start off with a female. Not too many females have showed up as the devil. So special marks go to Rosalinda from The Passion of the Christ. Creepy, but Elizabeth Hurley was meant to be funny. She's the Princess of Darkness, played extremely for laughs. She's the temptress who turns up and offers Brendan Fraser's character 7 wishes. He can get whatever he wants, but he's got to sell his soul. And I think as she was all pouty and kind of minxy, and Bedazzled wasn't a great movie, but I think she did encapsulate something, Elizabeth Hurley, of the temptation that most people, whether they believe seriously in the devil or not, knows enough about the devil to know the devil's a massive tempter. And I think Elizabeth Hurley captured that in her leotard.
But even then, even the fact that actually she helps us understand that people just don't take the devil terribly seriously.
No,
it's
they don't.
It's a comic effect.
Including
four.
Oh God, You Devil from 1984, starring George Burns, who was 88 years old at the time. There was a series of movies that George Burns, a famous American comedian who basically just lived forever, although he's now passed away. But he was an old comedian for a long time. And he started these.
That man was like born 90.
He's like Walter Matthau or like Steve Martin or Bill Murray. They always seem to have been born like at the age of 65. But George Burns, one of those guys, he was in this series of movies in the 80s called Oh God. And this is the third one, Oh God, You Devil. And you might be able to see where this is going, where George Burns, like Tom Hardy in Legend, up on screen at the moment, plays two characters, not necessarily twins, but they're effectively meant to be being represented almost as the same thing, where you've got God as George Burns and the devil as George Burns, or in this case, Harry O'Tofit. Harry O'Tofit is the name of the devil in Oh God, You Devil.
Now, actually, I think that's a Jewish reference.
Is it?
Tofit, yeah.
Okay, thank
you. There you go. You're welcome.
I got schooled on air. And so the devil shows up because there's a rock star who sold his soul for the devil and, you know, guess who shows up looking for payment, that kind of thing. This, like Bedazzled, the Elizabeth Hurley movie, is really strongly paid for 80s jokes. So it's the little things that amuse the devil, as it turns out, in the 80s, like making a waiter's pants fall down around their ankles so they trip over and fall into a pool.
That is 80s
devil.
Comedy.
So, as you just said, we don't tend to take the devil that seriously, and Oh God, You Devil is a massive example of that. Also, a special recommendation, shout out to Bill Cosby. Bill Cosby played the devil.
What?
In The Devil and Max Devlin, a Disney comedy in 1991. Almost got in there but I thought George Burns in Oh God, You Devil ranked higher.
Three.
I just mentioned Legend, that new film that's around at the moment starring Tom Hardy.
No, you don't.
Oh, yeah. In 1985, there was a movie called Legend that has nothing to do with the Cray family. Instead, Ridley Scott directed this fantasy movie about the Prince of Darkness called Darkness. But really, as you can see, if you've seen this, go and Google Tim Curry, who played this character in Legend at number 3 here on Satan's The Devil on Screen top 5 list. He plays a character called Darkness. And he shows up in like red body paint makeup, like it's just lurid red. He's got huge black horns, amazing prosthetics makeup on his face, hoofed feet, a booming voice. He kills unicorns. He's stealing dreams. And he's trying to corrupt innocence left, right, and center. And
this
devilish fiend will not do? This Lord of Darkness is trying to destroy the sun. He's trying to block out daylight. He's trying to destroy the light in Legend. And so what happens? Well, Tom Cruise has to show up and save the day.
That's why I groaned, because actually I think that Tim Curry does a brilliant job. Like, yeah, as this almost, you know, I don't want to say likable, but he has this character about him, this sort of, this devil. And then Tom Cruise turns up. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, you're right. And I think he sort of straddles the amusement and the terror idea of the devil, where as much as Elizabeth Hurley or George Burns are the cuddly or desirable versions of the devil, we're like, oh, they're not so bad. They just want to have a bit of wicked fun. This legend character, Darkness here, Tim Curry, I think encapsulates the seduction, the appeal of the devil, while also freaking you out as well, particularly as for kids. Like, imagine kids in the 80s going along to see Legend. Like, what the what?
Being scarred by Tom Cruise that early.
I wanted to, as I was going through the Satans on screen, I wanted to pick a really, really terrifying vision of Satan. I didn't find that too many of those as I was looking around, but a special commendation does go to Rosemary's Baby, which I found the most terrifying, quote-unquote, evil film I've ever seen. And the basic premise of that
not
movie...
Not a recommendation.
Is that a woman gets knocked up by the devil, and there's a scene in it where you see that happening. And so I didn't think the devil was on screen enough to warrant being in this top five list. But for anyone who wants to see the devil represented disturbingly on screen, Rosemary's Baby. But that's not a recommendation. That's just because it freaked me out. 1997, The Devil's Advocate, Al Pacino.
Yeah, okay, now the Pacino had to get a mention at some
point, didn't he?
As the devil.
Because his sort of peers, his acting peers like Jack Nicholson and Robert De Niro, they played the devil.
Yeah.
Jack Nicholson showed up as the devil in The Witches of Eastwick, and Robert De Niro in this really haunting supernatural thriller set in New Orleans called Angel Heart.
Yeah, he turns up as Lou Cipher.
Lou Cipher, what they did? Well, Al Pacino in The Devil's Advocate 1997 showed up as John Milton. Now, as history buffs may know, or literature buffs may know, John Milton was the author of the famous epic old poem Paradise Lost, which is about the fall of man at the hands of Satan. So, the character Keanu Reeves plays in this movie should have realized, or maybe something should have triggered in his mind, when he's a lawyer joining a firm headed by John Milton, Al Pacino's character, he might have been slightly suspicious maybe that, you know, this might not go so well in terms of good versus evil, might end up more on the evil side. He may not have expected, though, that John Milton, the Al Pacino character, is the devil shown up in the flesh for some reason working at a law firm in New York City.
I think that's possibly one of the great true American beliefs, you know, like there's a special level in hell for lawyers and the devil
and
himself turning up.
And here's the boss man. Al Pacino doing his thing, his wide-eyed, his grandstanding. Anyone who's seen an Al Pacino performance ever, this sort of encapsulates what people sometimes love and loathe about Al Pacino. He shows up as effectively the epitome of charismatic evil. That's what a Time Out reviewer said. I think they're on the money there. Seductive, mocking, powerful, seemingly unstoppable, and offering the entire world to Keanu Reeves Jr. in this firm.
There's a real Jesus on top of the mountain.
Yeah, I was going to say, it really feels like the portrait, and you can go and turn to like Luke chapter 3 and see where Jesus was tempted by the devil in the wilderness. Same kind of idea here. Instead, you get Keanu Reeves being tempted by Al Pacino.
Like me.
But in some of these speeches, though, it's really quite alarming what Al Pacino's character says in terms of, and I think he's really hitting on something that people feel about God. So from the devil's perspective, he's saying God mocks us, God set us up with unfair boundaries simply to poke fun of us. And really, the devil's on our side. The devil's been with us from the beginning. He's not trying to judge us.
Also offended party.
Exactly right. Exactly right. So you do get the kind of befriending side of the devil when you watch The Devil's Advocate with Al Pacino. That's at number two, though.
So,
I was trying to think, Mark, what is the most alarming manifestation of the devil that you could possibly conjure in your head? Not Elizabeth Hurley, but instead...
No, that's at one end of the scale.
Instead, a pint-sized little British boy, Harvey Spencer Stevens, is an actor who turned up as Damien in The Omen from 1976.
That film is freaky.
Is there any more chilling setup for a parent than bringing home baby and realizing it's the Antichrist?
Well,
it's the Antichrist.
It's sometimes a common experience, right? About like the ninth week, sleep deprived, and some of the things that come out of a child, you know? Anyway, I'll leave
it. So you may presume that your child is has a demonic possession going on in them, but not necessarily that they are the devil as a baby. So as much as Rosemary's Baby just terrified me, I think that film is a portrait of evil like nobody's business. Damien, this character in The Omen is this really chilling depiction in this quite effective horror thriller film from the 70s of just what a family will do when they slowly but surely start to realize that the devil showed up in their house. Terrifying stuff. So for my top five pick, I just had to land on Damien, this tiny kid from The Omen, to basically help us to realize that I think that the devil's a shocking presence in our lives, and we might be more shocked to realize that, you know, he could be a little bit closer to home than we think, not necessarily a child, but we should take it seriously, the presence in the world. And so I think that's represented by this little boy showing up in The Omen.
I was at the hospital, Mr. Thorne, the night your son was born. I saw its mother.
I have fears. I have fears.
What kind of fears?
Its mother, Mr. Thorne.
You saw my wife.
Its mother.
What is it you're trying to say?
His mother was a...
This is not a human child. Make no mistake.
There are those who will die for him. There are those who will kill for him. Who is he? What does he want? Where did he come from? And can he be stopped?
And can he be stopped? Well, I'm chilled to the bone just thinking about the creepy
good news
Damien.
Is that, there is an end to this story well worth reading. Check out the Gospels.
Yes.
I encourage you there. Things have been taken care of. Don't want to do any spoilers right now.
Spoiler alert, Jesus wins.
There you go. But spoilers, speaking of, coming up next week.
What is coming up next week?
Well, the Force is strong with next week's show, Ben. Ahead of the newest Star Wars movie being released next month, we check out the latest Star Wars cartoon for kids and wannabe Jedis everywhere.
We're going to review the cool cat comedy Mistress America and the tele-evangelist satire, Believe Me.
And I reveal the top five giant kid things from movie history. Yes, it's going to be... well, giant. That is the last.
I have been Ben McKechnie.
That is the last time you get to do this. We're not doing that special again. Okay, and I'm still Mark Hadley.
The Big Picture is a Bible Society Australia production and part of Hope 103.2's family of podcasts and vodcasts.